number of years ago, my family and I were traveling in Los Angeles. We had landed at the airport at LAX, and if any of you are familiar with that area, it's not the greatest part of town. Somehow I made the wrong turn, and of course, being a man, I didn't exactly correct that quickly, and we found ourselves in a rather shady part of town in the middle of the evening. And finally, I relented and stopped to ask directions. There was a police car pulled off to the side, and the first thing he said to me is, "What in the world are you doing here?" I basically said, "I'm trying to leave." But it is interesting sometimes how one wrong turn can set us in a place of great danger. And surely that is the case with David as we read the story in 2 Samuel. We need to remember the setting for this. And actually, as I understand this story, the story of David's sin with Bathsheba and related to Uriah and the rebuke that comes from Nathan in chapter 12 is bookended. That's a new word you'll have to put right down in your dictionary. But it's bookended with an account about the battle of Israel with the Ammonites at the beginning, and also that follow-up account at the end. So it's, I think we will not understand this story correctly until we understand its relationship to this matter of the battle with the Ammonites. But if you just think your way through 2 Samuel, you'll remember it begins with David's response to the death of Saul and Jonathan and his sons. David is deeply grieved. But after a series of events, we find in chapter 5 that David is now anointed the king over all of Israel, not just Judah, but over all of Israel, and he begins then his reign as the king. In chapter 6, David goes and defeats the Jebusites who possess the area of Jerusalem, or it was called Jebus. And he defeats them. Remember, they said something about you have to be blind and deaf, you know, you'll never get here. And David takes that citadel, makes it his own, makes it his city and his capital, and then fortifies it further to be a safe capital for him. And then later in chapter 6, he will bring the ark back to Jerusalem, where it will stay, and eventually where the temple will be built. In chapter 7, we come to that point where God makes his covenant with David. David wants to build a house, and playing off of that, God says to him, "You're a man of blood. You won't build the house, the temple for me, but I will build a house, that is, a dynasty for you. I will make from you, I will bring forth from you a kingdom that is eternal." And then he speaks some words, which I'll refer to later, about his blessing upon David and his reign as king. But God has now made a covenant with David for that eternal dynasty, which will, of course, be fulfilled ultimately in the person of our Lord Jesus. Then when you come to chapter 8 of 2 Samuel, you see that David is described as defeating all of those surrounding nations, all of those nations that surround Israel and that would have and would continue to pose a threat to the safety of that nation and the peace of that nation. And you will see the description of how he defeats the Philistines, those of from Aram, Moab, the Ammonites, Amalekites, and so on. And he takes tribute from them, and he takes the spoils of war and gathers it together. It is a strange but not an accidental statement, I think, that when you read in verse 15 of chapter 8, it says, "David reigned over all Israel. He guaranteed justice for all his people." That's kind of the high point, isn't it? The high water mark, and it's going to go downhill pretty quickly. In chapter 9, we find David, I think, now recognizing that his kingdom is fairly well established, and so he begins to take steps that you might say are in the peaceful direction, and the first of those is he wants to fulfill his covenant promise with Jonathan, that he would not only do harm, he would not do harm to Jonathan, but that he would actually seek to bring blessing to Jonathan and his offspring. And we know that Saul and his sons were killed by the Philistines in battle at the end of 1 Samuel. But David is intent on fulfilling that. And so he says, is there anyone left in the family of Saul that I may extend kindness to him? And you remember Ziba, one of the servants from Saul's household, said yes. He had a son who was injured when they were trying to escape, and he had his feet damaged. And his name is Mephibosheth. And so David summoned Mephibosheth, and he brings him to his table. He restores to him all of his father's land, has his servant and his servants farm that land for them. And Mephibosheth now becomes a regular at his table. When we come to chapter 10, now we come to the Ammonites. And something must have happened, because you will remember in 1 Samuel chapter 11, just after Saul had become king, the first instance in which Saul must lead the nation in battle is that he must deal with Nahash of the Ammonites, who has come to Jabesh-Gilead, you remember? And he has demanded that they surrender, and not only that they surrender, but that he will come and he will gouge out the right eye. Now, whether that's of only the soldiers or whether that's everybody, it may be a matter of debate, but you have to say that's not a particularly good offer any way you get it. And that's where Saul does battle with the Ammonites, and God gives the victory. Somewhere in between, it would seem, between then and now, there seems to have been not only a peace, but an actual kind of friendliness that existed between David and Nahash. Now, you remember that when David was fleeing from Saul, that he found sanctuary in a number of the other countries, like the Philistines, where he would go and hide out in Gath. And so it may have been during that time that David actually became somewhat friendly with Nahash, and so he passes away, and his son Hanun succeeds him. And David now wants to offer a gesture of kindness. I think Bruce Beatty was pointing this out on Friday, and I think he's right. Just as he wanted to show kindness toward Mephibosheth in chapter 9, he wants to show kindness toward Hanun, and in particular, his friendship with his father who had just passed away. And so David sends a delegation to express sympathy, and it sounds almost like the counselors that will come to Solomon's son after Solomon is off the scene and say, your father was hard, but we're going to be tougher. It's this sort of youthful arrogance that says, hey, look, they're not really coming to express sympathy. They're coming to spy out the land. And this is really an effort of war. And so it's almost as though he's trying to pick a fight. He doesn't kill them, but he humiliates them. Now, for a Hebrew, for a Jew, to have his beard either plucked out or shaven off would be a shameful thing. They do that to these men, and then they provide them with miniskirts, if I can say it delicately, and they go home with the end in view. And they're shamed. And so David says to his men, when he finds out, you go and you stay there until your beards have grown out, and then you come back. But it's obvious to Hanun that he has greatly offended David, and it seems almost as though he's tried to pick a fight. So he now gathers up some hired soldiers, 20,000 foot soldiers, it says, from Aram or from Syria, And he gathers up another 12,000 men from Ish-Tob. And he now has this mercenary army that joins his own to do battle against Israel because he knows David is coming. And indeed, he is. But notice this in verse 7 of chapter 10. When David heard the news, he sent Joab and the entire army to meet them. That word is a very fascinating word, and I was reading an excellent article that looks at this whole story of David and how the word sent is so crucial, especially in chapter 11 and then picking up again in verse 12. But notice this, when we read in chapter 11, verse 1, that David stayed in Jerusalem and he did not go out, but sent Joab and his servants and all of the armies. It's not the first time. The first time is in chapter 10. So David has sent out Joab, and he and his brother divide their forces, and one goes against the Ammonites, and the other goes against the Arameans or the Syrians. And the Syrians are defeated, and they give up, and they make their, you know, they're just, that's it. And the Ammonites flee to their city. I take it they flee to the capital city of Reba, and there, behind the fortifications, they sort of secure themselves. The Syrians are not quite done. They want to take another pass at it, and in so doing, they are badly defeated. And they make their peace. And from that point on, they're not going to get themselves, money or not, they're not going to get themselves caught between the Ammonites and David. They're out of the picture. So when we come to chapter 11, what we find is that the battle with the Ammonites is really not over. It's not finished. They ran away. They hid in the capital city of Reba. And now it's got to have to be finished. And David sends Joab and his forces. Notice it says he sent Joab with his officers and the entire Israelite army. Some of the texts say, and his servants. You remember that David, like other kings of that time, had their foreign, you could call them mercenaries, but I'm not sure that's really the right term. They had this group of select people, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, who apparently at least one of those groups came from Philistia. And in the early days when David was fleeing from Saul, these people identified themselves with David and they became his faithful followers, and they were literally like his secret service in terms of his security force. So they seemed to go wherever David went, but David sends them as well as the armies of Israel to go fight against the Ammonites in Reba. That's where we find him when we come to chapter 11. Part of the point of saying all of this is the war is almost completely over. They are virtually at the point where most all of Israel's enemies have already been defeated. And they're just, it's like they're 5 yards from the finish line. And once this thing with the Ammonites is taken care of, then it's virtually all taken care of. And we saw that back in chapter 8, where it describes all of those surrounding nations that have been defeated. And there is this one last thing. Had it not been for the arrogance of Hanun, who wouldn't leave the friendly status between Israel and his nation, then it would have been done then. But here is this last battle that is to be won. And the tragedy is, David is so close to experiencing that which God had spoken about in chapter 7. And that is where there would be peace within Israel, and where the work and the preparation toward the building of the temple could be done, and whatever. Where war was finally a thing of the past. They're right on the brink of that as this event occurs to us. And so that's where we find ourselves when we come to chapter 11. Here is David. He has sent even his elite group onto the battle. And it seems to me they have done battle with the Ammonites, and they finally won the victory down to coming to the capital city. And here their job is to besiege the city. And that's not a really a very exciting kind of war. It's a little safer. But basically, you surround the city, you cut off their water supply and their food supply, and sooner or later, as Jerusalem well knew and experienced, sooner or later, they got to give up. There's just nothing else to do. But it's kind of a dull life, would you not agree? You're not in the city if you're part of the Israeli army. You're outside the city, as Uriah will say, camping in the field. And you're just keeping people from coming out and from going in. There's no need to get close to the wall if you're simply waiting for them to surrender. You simply keep your distance, cut off all their supplies, and the end will come. But that, of course, is not what happens in our text. So here is David, not leading the army of Israel, staying in Jerusalem. And so he is in his comfort, and we know from the story that he sleeps in. He gets up in the evening. That's not normally when one gets up. He gets up in the evening, and that is the point at which he sees that which he should not. Sends for information about this beautiful woman, and then summons her, sends others to bring her, and of course, the event which we probably don't need to describe any further than that. She will later send word that she is pregnant, and that's when things get difficult for David. How is he going to mask the sin? And you remember when David sent some of his messengers to tell Job, send Uriah back to give a report. And there is a sadness as you read the conversation between David and Uriah. In verse 7 of chapter 11, when Uriah came to him, David asked about how Joab and the army were doing and how the campaign was going. He already knows, and he doesn't really care. It's a sham. And then he says to him, go to your home and relax. Now, that's kind of a polite way of saying something a little more than that, and everybody knew it, and Uriah in particular understood what that meant. And I want you to think about that, the temptation of that. In effect, what he's saying to Uriah is, you have the right, in fact, I even command you to do what I'm doing, in the sense of be comfortable, eat good meals, have a good night's rest in your own bed, all of those kinds of things I'm offering to you. You don't have to, you know, you've come. He doesn't say from war. Notice, he says you've come from a journey. You know, it's not quite what's going on. I mean, he has had to make the journey, but it isn't the journey he's come from. He's come from the battlefield. And so he says to him, in effect, go to your home. And his hope is that he would do what almost any man would do, and that is to go to his home, to enjoy the comforts of his bed, and hopefully mask the fact that he was the father of that child that Bathsheba would bear, rather than Uriah. And so here the scenario unfolds, and Uriah, it says, stayed at the door of the palace with all of the servants of his lord. He would not go down to his house. Isn't that an interesting thing? Now, I don't know how many of you have traveled overseas, and I have to tell you, my travels overseas in recent years are sure a lot more cozy and comfortable than they were in the early days. I can remember one time when I was in Asia and I slept in this house, which was a lot better accommodations than other people had, but slept in this house in a sleeping bag, and the mice would run over the sleeping bag, and the only thing I really cared about was they didn't go over my face. Somehow I just had a thing about that. And there were rats, of course, around too, and I'd prefer that those guys kept their distance. But you can imagine now, when you come home, if somebody were to say to you, well, like it's Singapore or somewhere else, and to say to you, why don't you spend the night in this really fancy hotel, and why don't you go out and have French fries and all the kinds of hamburgers and whatever. I've seen people cheer from an airplane at a McDonald's arch. Now, does that tell you how bad it is overseas sometimes in some of the places you stay? I'm going to tell you, not too many people cheer for McDonald's, but some people who have been abroad, they do. And so here's the golden opportunity for the king to tell you it is right for you, in fact, it is your obligation to do what he has said. He has permission to indulge himself. And yet he sleeps in the doorway of the palace. It's my opinion that he does so because he sees his mission as protecting his king. Now, Uriah's a really interesting fellow. He, remember, later on in 2 Samuel, is the one who is one of those 30 magnificent men. He's one of those great men. And Bathsheba's father is also one of those great men. So it's not, I suppose, any great mystery as to how Uriah would have met Bathsheba and then come to have been her husband. But he is a great man, and I believe he sees it. It is his mission and his calling to protect the life of his king. Isn't that irony? Isn't that a horrible kind of thing? That here is a man camping in the doorway of his king rather than taking those extra steps. And we know that Uriah's house is within sight of the king's palace, do we not? We already know that from what we've read about what David has done. I mean, just a few steps, he could have been home. Or he could have spent the night there and then spent the last few minutes, you know, laying in the doorway. He spends the whole night in the doorway with the king's servants. He will not take the king's offer. And so that's told to David in verse 10. He didn't go down to the house. Everything about this seems to indicate to me that there are a number of people who are aware of what has happened and what David is trying to do. And they're basically saying it didn't work. And so David is going to try again. Haven't you just arrived from a journey? Why haven't you gone down to your house? And here are the words of Uriah that just strike me. The ark and Israel and Judah reside in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and my lord's soldiers are camping in the open field. Should I go to my house to eat and drink and have marital relations with my wife? As surely as you are alive, I will not do this thing. Uriah is the man David should have been. Uriah is the man who understands what being at war means. And he will not cease to be a soldier just because he is in Jerusalem. David ceased to be a soldier when he was in Jerusalem. Uriah will not. He will not indulge himself in those good things that in other times would have been acceptable. He will not eat the good food because they're out on K rations. He will not sleep in a comfortable bed because they're laying out in the open field. He will not do the things that the king has urged him to do. I will not do this thing. So David says to Uriah, stay here another day. Tomorrow I'll send you back. So that night he keeps him alongside himself and he gets him drunk. And David says to himself, maybe when he's sober, he's a man of principle. But when he's drunk, I know he's going to do what I want him to do. And even drunk, he would not go to his own house. Even drunk, he would not do the things David had urged him to do. And that prompts David then to send the letter by Uriah. Isn't this just one of those gut-wrenching texts where here goes Uriah with a message in his hand to Joab that says, kill him in war and make it look like a part of what the battle is. That is precisely what Saul had tried to do to David. He wanted him to go out and do battle and get killed in battle and he would be rid of his troubles. So Nathan goes, and you know, he is sent out into that worst place, the strongest place along the wall, brought too close. And not only Uriah, but a number of other valiant men lose their lives that day because of the purpose of David to kill Uriah. I'll tell you, David has fallen a long, long ways. Where did David go wrong? Well, it was his duty as king to lead in battle. Now, I'm going to deal with another text next week that talks about David when he gets old, too old to fight the Goliaths of the day. And his people finally say to him, David, it's not a good thing for you to go to battle anymore. We don't want our king to be killed. I mean, can you imagine David out there fighting a battle with his walker? Did you see the story in the news this week about this lady that was Miss America in like 1944? And somebody is trying to rob her again, and she goes out with her shotgun, I think it was, and she holds onto her walker while she shoots the tires out of these guys' cars. Saying, whoa, I'm for her. I'd vote for her today. But David will become too old to fight. But he is not too old to fight here. He just doesn't want to. The last big battle, the last few yards before he crosses the finish line, the last battle before peace comes to the nation. And David makes the choice to stay home, to stay in bed, to abuse his power. Not only his power with respect to Bathsheba, but his power with respect to Uriah has him killed. That's where you see the interesting word in chapter 12, verse 1. So the Lord sent Nathan to David. David's been sending, using his power. Now God's about to send. And he tells the story about the rich man and the poor man. The rich man with his great flocks, the poor man with his one little lamb. And this lamb is not just a lamb, it is a pet lamb. And it eats, it's like it's at our house. It eats the food from the table. And you know, it goes everywhere we go and whatever. It's part of the family. And what's really interesting is look what it says at the end of verse 3. It was just like a daughter to him. You know what the word Hebrew word for daughter is? Bath. Bathsheba. I mean, there's just this irony in this. Why would he say that? And it, you know, he's letting these details drop. And all of a sudden, when he hears what Nathan has to say, thou art the man. Oh, by the way, he says, David, in his anger, he must pay for the lamb four times over. How many of his sons did he lose prematurely in early death? He lost the baby boy, right? He lost Amnon. He lost Absalom. He lost Adonijah. Four of his sons die premature deaths. Interesting that he would pick that particular number. And then he says to him, because he has done this thing, he has abused grace and it has turned to greed, and God would have given him more. Listen, I don't think he could name his grandchildren at this stage. Can you imagine with all of the wives and the concubines that he had, and you said to him, you know, name your grandkids? I don't think he could do it. And God says to him, listen, I've given you all of this. I would have given you more. But you had no right to take what wasn't yours. The wife of Uriah, your faithful soldier. And so he says, when David confesses, he says, you will not die, but you will suffer. You will suffer the kinds of things that you have done in private. You will suffer in public. And you know, of course, that those things are going to come. And so he spells out what will come, and it begins with the death of that son. It's interesting to me, 12 times in this text, the son is called the child, the child, the child, the child. And I keep saying, what brand was it? Well, we're told in verse 14, it's the son But it's just an interesting way of referring to this child without saying the boy. I'm not sure why, but the text seems to use the more generic way of expressing that. Now, what I want to do is I don't want to end up focusing altogether on David. I preached this before, and if you want to look at all those things, you can do that. This is like the message that I did on David and Jonathan. And what I want to do is focus on the magnificent man that Uriah was. I mean, think about what it took for Uriah to be where he was. Uriah is a Hittite. That means he's a foreigner, correct? He's a foreigner. And what did God tell the Israelites they were to do to the Hittites, among others? They were to annihilate them. He was not only a foreigner who had no part, so to speak, in the promises of God to Israel, or so it seemed, but he actually, because of his identification with his people, he actually was condemned to die. And I couldn't help, as I thought through the details with Uriah, I thought to myself in terms of Ephesians chapter 2. I mean, remember what he says? We're outside. We're separate from the covenant people of God. We're sinners whose sins have kept us from God and separated us from God and placed us under condemnation. That's what Uriah was. And yet he chose to identify himself with David. I don't know when. The text does not tell us when or exactly how. But at some point in time, this man changes his allegiance. He ceases to be a Hittite in the sense of his allegiance and his identification. He ceases to be a Hittite, and he now becomes a follower of David. From that moment on, friends, he could not go back. He could not go back to his Hittite friends and say, "Oh, it was a bad mistake. Just take me back." He has identified himself with David, the king of Israel. And the interesting thing is, he identifies himself with David, the king, before he's the king, if I understand correctly. I don't think that he has linked himself with David late in the game. I suspect he is one of those men who has linked himself with David. He may be one of those that came with David from Gath or from some other place where David has gone in his hiding. So here's a man who not only chose to find his identity with David and therefore with Israel, but he may well have chosen to make his stake with David at a time when David was still a felon fleeing from Saul. And all I'm saying is, isn't that sort of a picture of us? That we identify ourselves with a crucified Christ before his coming and his taking over this world and setting up his kingdom, before all of that's done, we identify ourselves. We were outside the pale of God's promises to Abraham, it seemed, at least in a physical way. We identify with our Lord Jesus in his rejection. And the picture that Uriah has for us is that we would remain faithful to him no matter what, even when his king sends him to his death. Now, obviously, David is not as good a picture of Messiah as Uriah is of the saint. But there is a picture, nevertheless. And it seems to me that we need to focus our attention not just on David and his sins, but on what this man can teach us. What were the consequences? Well, Nathan had said there were going to be some terrible consequences, and I'm going to tell you this because this should wipe the smile from anybody's face. I'm not sure how many times in my ministry I've heard it said, and I'm not sure how many times other people have heard it said, but it has been said over and over. Well, David sinned, and the inference is David sinned, God forgave, and it really wasn't so bad. And I've said to people like that, You may get away with it, but I guarantee you will never end up with a smile on your face. I have never seen anybody willfully choose to sin, assuming and presuming God would forgive it and must forgive it, and come out at the end of their life and say, it was worth it all. It never is worth it. Look what happens to him. Not only the loss of the child that comes early on, but then the rape of his daughter by Amnon. What a horrible thing for a father to experience. And then Amnon's death at the hand of Absalom. And then Absalom, whom he loves, fleeing away where David can't even enjoy the fellowship of his son. And then that son returning to win the hearts of the kingdom and to rebel against you and take over your kingdom, at least temporarily. And then on the roof of the palace, pitch his tent with your concubines to broadcast to all of Israel something that had been done in private by David. I don't think you would say it was worth it all. It was not. David sinned. David was forgiven. But David did not have a smile on his face when it came to the consequences for his sin, and no one ever will. No one ever will. Well, I want to focus for a minute again on something I alluded to earlier. Think of what would have been apart from this sin. Look at what God says to David. He says in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel and verse 9. 2 Samuel 7, 9. I was with you wherever you went. I defeated all your enemies before you. Now I will make you as famous as the great men of the earth. I will establish for a place for my people Israel and settle them there. They will live there and not be disturbed anymore. Violent men will not oppress them again as they did in the beginning. And during the time when I appointed judges, to lead my people Israel, instead I will give you relief from all your enemies. The Lord declares to you that he himself will build a dynastic house for you. And he goes on to make his promises about his descendant. Think of what could have been had David not messed up at this point, just yards before the finish line. And instead of his kingdom now moving to that part where it would be almost, at least in those, it would be the glory days of his kingdom. They don't exist. They don't exist for David. They never will. He will regain his kingdom, but at the loss of his son. It could have been a wonderful thing. Now, here's some applications. One, the good guys don't always win in this life. The good guys don't always win. There are some who would give us the message that all we have to do is just have enough faith, enough faithfulness, and God has just got to give us all the good things. Uriah would be somebody we'd have to give some thought to, I think. It doesn't, in terms of what we read about Uriah, it doesn't get better than that. He was a faithful man, and he was killed by the king for whom he would lay down his life. What a tragedy. The good guys don't always win in this life. I'm going to pause there for a second. Which is exactly why there is life after death. I was thinking about it this week in terms of the tragedy that took place in Virginia. I was thinking how Satan has done a number on people. Think about this. In the Middle East and elsewhere, there are terrorists who are killing people in throngs, thinking that when they do so, they're going to go to heaven and they're going to get these wonderful rewards. Is that not doing a number on people? When Hebrews talks about people who through all of their lives are dominated and bound by the fear of death. And here are people who are literally lining up in greater and greater numbers today. Not only to die themselves, but to take people out with them because of a misunderstanding about what lies ahead. They believe in a future afterlife, but Satan has twisted that to a lie. And think of the horror when you wake up and you find that it was a lie. And then in Virginia, there's the opposite, I suspect, and that is the refusal to believe there's anything after death. And therefore, I can end my emotional or physical or some other form of suffering. I can vent my anger on all kinds of people, and it just ends. It just ends. It doesn't. It doesn't just end. There is a reward for the good guys. If not in this life, and there will be some reward in this life, there will be for sure the final reward. All these died without receiving the promise, the writer says, because they were looking for the heavenly city that God had said would come. Secondly, the good guys are not always good. Do not put your faith in men. Do not put your faith in men. Even the best of men will fail. And the farther up you are, not only the harder you fall, the faster you fall. It's an amazing thing with David that you think of a man who is called the man after God's own heart, and look how quickly it happened. We are creatures who are prone to wander. As the song says, Lord, I feel it. We better feel it because it's true. Even the best of men can and at times will fall. And that is why only Messiah can bring the kind of kingdom that he has promised. Sin often starts with a seemingly harmless decision or action. Now, I'm not so sure that we can say exactly where in David's life it began in chapter 11. It certainly began with his decision to stay home rather than to go to war. From chapter 10, we see he's done that once before. So somewhere in David's life, he made what seemed to be a rather innocent choice. But it set him off in a path that ended up in disaster. And I simply have to say, within the hearing of my voice, people are on that path. People are on that path. It has to be that they've made decisions that seem innocent, but somewhere down at the end of that path may well be disaster. And if this text says anything, the sooner you get off it, the better. David's sin just snowballed. It just got worse and worse and worse, because he didn't confess it and deal with it at the time. And so I simply say to you, if you're on a path that really does not feel like Uriah describes it, then you ought to think about it. Here's another one. Sin hurts others. Isn't it tragic? I mean, here's a little baby that dies because of David's sin. Here's a daughter that's raped. Here is a kingdom that's thrown into turmoil, and people have to make decisions about who they are to follow. Blood is shed. All of it because of one path, one man's choices, one man's sin. Sin hurts others. Now, I call this message early retirement, and I want to do a little caveat. I saw Rick smile already. Hey, folks, I'm not talking about work. I am not talking about work. But I was trying to capture in my mind, what is it? What is it about David that went wrong? And I think the best description I can give is early retirement. David decided to retire in the sense of not going to battle when the battle was still going on. It wasn't time for David to quit. Now, next week, I'm going to tell you, the sad reality is when it was time for David to quit, he wouldn't. That's a whole different story. But here, he takes early retirement, not in the sense of what God had given him to do. And that's the thing that concerns me today. I don't care about when you start drawing Social Security. That's academic. In fact, it may be academic whether you get Social Security. What am I saying? But it's you know, what's important is that God has given us a task to do. He may well give us retirement to give us the freedom to carry that task to the full. That's fine. Take early retirement in that sense. But don't turn in your badge. Don't turn in your mantle in terms of the ministry God has given. Just as God called David to be the king and to lead his nation in war and to bring it to peace, so God has given to each one of us who are believers a task to fulfill and the gifting to do that. And there are going to be times when we're just flat tired. And we would love to crawl in that feather bed, sleep in late, whatever it is that keeps us from doing our job. But God has given us a task. And when we take early retirement on ministry, we have taken the first step that David took to disaster. Last words. We're in war. And when we're in war, we must think like those who are at war. I walked in the hall and I was looking for that sign. Do you remember the one, that the poster that was up on the hallway going up to the second floor? And it was sort of something like, you know, when you're at war, you change the way you live and stuff. It's gone. I don't know what happened to it. If I had it, I'd hang it right here. We are at war. And what that means is that you and I need to think about it that way. We need to live our lives that way. Uriah said, I know I'm here in Jerusalem. I know my wife is around the block and my feather bed is there too and a delicious meal. But I'm a soldier. My men are out there on that battlefield. They're not eating like I am, and I will not eat like they do. I will not have the luxuries that they don't have until they have them too. And I want to say to you, I went to a board meeting of the Indian Evangelical Mission Friday night. And I saw a video of the place that I had gone to about 25 years ago, up in the mountains of Maharashtra, in a little village called Chikaldara, in a tiger preserve. And that little village now has the Bible in their own language and a church that has started in that period of time. But my brothers and sisters lived there in huts, for 15 or 20 years, translating the scriptures into that language. They paid a high price. And what I challenged my fellow board members to think about was, look, our brothers and sisters are at war. They're living in huts. They're eating simple meals. How can we go about living life as though nothing were going on when in reality it is? I'm not trying to guilt trip people about the fact that they have a you don't have to sleep on your floor tonight or to eat only cornflakes. But we ought to remember that we are a part of an army and that army is suffering greatly around the world today. And we ought never to forget it. We ought to be praying for them. We ought to be sacrificially involved with them. We ought to be like Uriah. We are at war. And when we choose to live the life of luxury indifferent to our fellow believers who are soldiers on the field, that's the point at which we're tempted, like David. And that's a dangerous place to be. Father, we thank you for Uriah. We thank you for Nathan and his faithfulness in speaking for you. We're thankful, too, for your grace, for the way that you forgave David. But help us to learn from David that it is not time to retire until the war is over. Help us to understand that. Help us to practice that in Jesus' name. Amen.